Nils.
Tilman.
Hi.
Hi. Web usability.
Web usability.
What do you think makes web usability different from other types of usability? So compared to, I don't know, build a native iOS or Windows application. Why is it web usability something special?
Well, it depends. I mean, I grew up with first web, thinking about web, and then thinking about apps and mobile. So it's weird to put it that way. Because for me, the web has always been, or not actually, but it was the first thing being around. I think from, you know, how we've seen the app network, the economy of apps evolve, and the mess in the Wild West that we've seen the last 13 years now? That we've seen kind of a similar consolidation, right? In the beginning, where when everyone was creating their own apps and everyone had different notions about it, everyone's doing it with their own style and intent, to a point where we're now at where they're kind of like converging on this is an app, kind of like this idea of here's a design for the logo, here's a design for a navigation menu, here's a design for communicating with the user, interaction design. And I think that is very similar to, it's kind of like consolidation that we've seen early on with website, where when HTML came out and people were just going wild using CSS and then HTML to build the craziest things, and then we moved to, okay, here's what actually works, here's what's actually effective, here's what actually causes users to spend some more time on your website, and so on. So I think there's more in common than there's different.
And maybe there's the same process that happens. I remember like a very long time ago when I wrote applications for Microsoft DOS, right? No Windows, no framework, you just write your application and you just put pixels on the screen or like other method, but that's was the start when I started. And then, but then frameworks came along, and for other systems there were already frameworks, but then I think I used Turbo Pascal, and they had then a framework for developing graphical user interface. They weren't really graphical in the current sense, but then new, more and more frameworks came along. And then, I mean, Windows, that was an entire framework. And for other systems, you, of course, had also such frameworks. So maybe that's something like in the evolution, you set up a new platform and then people do whatever without any support. And they're crazy and they do wild things. And then it consolidates over time. And for the web, we see that now for quite a long time, but we also saw that for, I think, apps, right? Mm-hmm. I think for Android, that's now very well-defined standard, how your app should look like and what kind of components you should use. And you can still do things differently, but you probably wouldn't.
And it's interesting how these frameworks really are, I think, informed, because what they are is on one hand, they're guidelines, right? Here's what this should be looking like. And then there are tools hiding the complexity of getting there. And it's interesting for me to see how a lot of these frameworks have really been informed by a lot of the work that came out of our field, HCI, right? If you think of Jacob Neilson's 5 quality components for usability, right? Learnability, efficiency, memorability, errors, and satisfaction, all these things culminating into what we now consider this is good design, because it actually, even without specifically attributing it to those 5 components, they are really weaved into most 2 of these frameworks and therefore used widely across the web and hopefully most of the apps.
Yeah. But I think what happens through this process and also what you mentioned is that we now have much more consistency compared to like previous times, right? If we think about early websites, I still have in my lectures, I still show examples of like terrible websites. But most of them are old examples because the websites, they don't exist anymore, or the companies don't exist anymore because they probably went bankrupt. And they were super inconsistent. Like, they all looked differently, and they, I mean, back in the days, they had animated GIFs and they were funny and interesting, but not very nice to use. And I think that's that's something we probably got through all these frameworks, is that we have now more consistency in the web. Because I think, like, in general, consistency is super hard on the web because there is no authority. Like, for iOS or for Android or for Windows, there's always an authority. Someone is telling you, design it in this way. And then if you don't want to think, you just design it in that way. And I mean, Apple even enforces that you design it in that way, right? But for the web, there's no one enforces any design, right? Maybe the user is doing
the
that.
The user eventually, yeah. And the incentives behind what you want the user to do, right? That's the authority, really. I mean, you say they're consistent, but your university's website is very different from my university's website.
That's true, yeah. I looked at both of them, and what I find interesting is, and I think that brings us to a completely different topic, is that if I go to your university's website, then I did that on my mobile, and then there was, I think, three sections. I could say, I'm a new student, I'm a researcher, or I don't know, I'm currently a student. And that makes a lot of sense, because your university, right, I go there and they don't know what I'm interested in. And we, like, the different user groups have completely different user profiles. They are interested in completely different things. If you go to my university's website, I don't know. It's like, it's a website, and then they show, my impression is they show all this content at the same time. So you're not sure, is it, who should be interested in this part?
Right.
And I think that.
Yeah, it's funny because that's one of the things, right, that we do in HCI. We look at different stakeholders or personas that might be using our services and apps, and then we design the user journey through our services for specific personas. And I think, you know, one of the challenges of the web is they pop out of nowhere and land on your website, and then you as a website designer have to make sense of who's this user, how did they get here, what do they want, right? And the way University of Melbourne does that is through self-selection, right? One of the first things they ask you is, you know, are you an international student, are you a domestic student, are you a staff member, are you a member of the press, and so on, right? I guess more sophisticated websites do it with cross-website tracking. They kind of like figure out how to use the trails that people leave when they surf through the web to figure out who this person is, what their demographics look like, and then customize experience accordingly. But that's something I guess we've seen dangerously in recent years. And that probably also some of the universities would really like to tap into if you think about the incentives behind that.
Yeah, I think that's part of the difference, right, between the university system in Australia and in Germany, that you have different interests, and like there's more of an incentive to get international students in Australia compared to Germany. I mean, we also want them, but then, yeah, if you don't get them, whatever, right? And I think that, so the website probably becomes much more important, and so more effort is invested into creating a good website that's not necessarily visually pleasing. I think that's not it, but like that supports these different user groups better than just having some kind of website. I mean, for the different German websites I've been to, I think, or when I was at different German universities, I basically never used the websites directly. I always used Google. And I think everyone is doing that. And maybe there are other people, but my current university, I tested their search, and it's like, it's funny, it's so bad that it's funny. But that's not, it's not just my university, that's all university search functionalities I ever tested, they were terrible. they never worked. So I always use Google because that's the only option to find something on these sites. A problem is they break if it's internal. So if there's internal content, then you cannot use Google anymore. Then it's not. Yeah.
When I was a student, I was working for a furniture company, or actually an interior design company who was selling furniture on the web. And I did implement a website specific search for their products. And that it's not easy, right? Because all of a sudden you have to deal with all these things such as typing errors. You know, how do you deal with permutations of categories of actual products and so on? And everything that can happen in between. And then how do you make that search efficient across, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of items? And yeah, it's so much easier to just, you know, create a nice index that can be crawled by Google's robots and then just outsource that particular piece. But I think back then the notion of a website was you need to support two types of users, right? The one that had come to look for a specific thing, like that are searching, and then the browsing type, right? Who just wants to see what's out there. And it's, let's see what this University of Regensburg has to offer, right? But I think with more sophistication in terms of figuring out who's my user, and also the incentive behind, we need to retain that user as long as we can, before they go to another university website and check out their portfolio. That has led to a lot of the innovations in that field, or a lot of the more finely crafted design of those websites to support individual information needs.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is still the case, that you can in general say there are these different user groups? I mean, apart from like at university, sure, you have I don't know, the lecturer is different from a student, but that you have like general categories of people, is that still, do you think that's still relevant?
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely. I think thinking in terms of personas and what they want to achieve when using a product or service is absolutely crucial. And even more so now that we can, I think, cut them up into much more fine-grained user segments. Right, because a website in the 90s was pretty much just, here's what I do, here's who I am, right? If you think of the first, what was it called? MySpace, you know? Here are my favorite pizzas and my favorite bands and whatnot, right? It's all about presentation. But now websites are apps, right? Web apps, literally. And the complexity of what they can do and how they can help you is much higher. And so people do way more things on the web now than they did 30 years ago. And so therefore we also need to, there was a need to categorize the user much more fine-grained than what was back then, literally just a walk through the you know, halls of the internet.
I think that's also interesting because, I mean, I have a website, you have a website, but why do we have these websites? What's our product? Why? What do we try to sell, or what do we try to achieve with these websites? I have a rough idea with that, but I think that it's not as trivial as people often think. So what's the product of my university's website? What are they trying to achieve? I mean, and I think it's not like usability is not the... It's probably at the core of it, but that's not the goal. So my university or my website, my private website, the goal is not to have a great usability. The goal is to achieve something. And I think that's the same for the university's website. The goal is not to have a great usability, but maybe great usability is part of it to reaching that goal. But I think like asking what do you expect people to do on your website? So what's the purpose of the website? I think that's something that's important, because if you look at news websites, the purpose is again not great usability, which, I mean, it's obvious from all these ads and all these things that are shown, right? It's not usability, it's something else. It's making people click on ads or whatever. So I think that And if you, I mean, if you want to improve these websites' usability, the easiest thing would be remove all the ads, and then you achieve a nice usability.
Well, I think it's a fine line, right, between how much usability, how much can I compromise on usability to push my ads before people will, you know, get fed up with it and then leave or close the window. And this is where we've seen, you know, this notion of dark patterns really come in. Right. So there's kind of like this crafting a UI in the sense where you get the user to do what you want them to do. Right. I think this is a term that goes back to Harry Brignall, who's an experienced designer in 2010, and he put out this website, darkpatterns.org, and with all the sneaky techniques, you know, that apps and websites have been using to kind of like retain users, keep them from deleting their data or their accounts, from clicking ads, from you know, sneaking stuff into their basket and such. And it's fascinating to look through those because there are really sophisticated insights into how design can nudge people towards certain decisions, right? So if we think of, for example, the default options, for example, in when you sign up for an account, right? Then probably the checkbox is already there where you sign up for the newsletter. Or if it's not there, right, it might say, do not send me more information about your products, right? So kind of like these trick questions. I think someone also analyzed Amazon and the process for deleting your account, which is inherently complex to find. And so these are, they call them Roach Motel. And like, it's really easy to get into, but then good luck getting out of there, right? Oftentimes, I mean, I've seen this more painfully in commercial websites where things sneak themselves into my shopping cart. So for example, the flight agencies, right, that are really cheap and really attractive. Yes, I want to go to Solomon Islands for $50. And then by the end, you get to the checkout process, right? And you've already invested 15, 20 minutes just comparing flights, putting in your address, selecting seats, getting your credit card information in there. And then just before the last button, they tell you, oh, and here are all the things that we add on top of your bill, right? Such as, oh, you selected seats. You paying with a credit card we don't like. And for some reason, they never like any of the credit cards that I use. So therefore, there's always a $15 extra charge, right? And so these are kind of like sneaking stuff into things without being very upfront of them, because by the time I'm getting there, I'm so invested in this process that I'm saying, okay, screw that, right? I'll pay the $25 extra because I'm not going to go through that process again. More recently, so four years ago, I think what was very effective during the presidential election was ads that are disguised as news articles, right? And I think Politico was a website that was very famous to do that, where you could buy ads and the editors would make them look like they were actual part of the editorial content. And obviously that with purchased content comes a lot of the guided information that people want to get out there. And so, yeah, that's a sneaky business, the whole dark patterns art. And it's interesting to understand how they work, and it's interesting to think about the psychology that they use to get you where they want you to do. Have you seen any recent examples where usability seems to break down on websites?
I think like the worst thing is you go to a website and then you get this, oh, I put cookies on your PC, I do this and this and this, and then the first thing you have to do is you have to close all these different dialogues. And then sometimes there are three, and afterwards you're on a website you don't want to be. I think that this whole thing made things a lot worse. And I think people don't realize that, so developers don't see that, because it's their website. They checked all these boxes. Everyone at that company having this website, they don't see these dialog boxes. Only new people see that. And so if you go to a lot of different websites, you see a lot of these boxes and they are quite terrible. But if you're a frequent user of this this website, you don't see that. And I think that that currently changed the web quite a bit, because I don't want to go on new websites, because then I got more of these random dialog boxes that I have to close. And that comes in addition to me learning how to use websites. So I think that's something that is both quite terrible. And I think people went the wrong way. So they had this website, the website was collecting all this data, wonderful. And now they had to, because of the EU, it had to change that. And they had to, if they want to continue collecting all this data, they had to show all these dialog boxes. And I think the better way would have been collect less data from your new users. And then maybe after a while, right? I only collect the bare minimum that I know, that person accessed my website. And then over time, if a person comes back, then I want to do something with it.
Well, technically, you're now legally obliged to only collect the necessary information, right? GDPR, I think, has a very clear stance on you cannot collect data just for the fun of it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I can. I mean, not. I have to have a purpose and a reason, right? So there must be a reason for it. Well, yeah, there are always reasons for collecting data, I would say. And I have to tell you, right? So that's the other thing. And then telling you that's really painful, because I don't want to tell you why I collect all this data about you. I mean, basically, I want to serve you more ads and target to them. So that's, yeah. So I think there are lots of bad examples out there when it comes to usability. And yeah, we talked about some of them. But do you have examples of fantastic UX or fantastic websites where you think this really shines?
Not in a sense of where I recently stumbled on a website and thought, wow, right? Because I think we are at a point where the website variety has somewhat consolidated. Right, because of also there's lots of frameworks that people use, and then there's lots of conventions now that we have, right? So for example, if you think of when flat design came along and iOS adopted the flat design, which was very simplistic color schemes, getting rid of the 3D effects of buttons and stuff like this, right? And that was a really clean way of designing interface, and all of a sudden everyone was using that. It became kind of like a standard. And then Google came along with the material design. And then it's kind of like a fashion thing, right? But basically, whenever there's a dominating fashion trend in terms of design, I think a lot of people follow. And so therefore, it seems like a lot of websites not only look very similar or function very similar, but it also serves the purpose that even though I navigate to a completely new website, I intuitively know where to find what, because the conventions have propagated right throughout these websites. And so for example, the search bar, you know, I always look at the top for the search bar. If you don't do that, well, shame on you, because people won't find your search bar, for example, right? And so there haven't been many like surprises, I would say, lately, because it's all quite like positive surprises. Because a good website is kind of like a website that seems familiar to you, right? And that makes the whole process of seek and find very efficient or effective.
I think that brings us a bit back to the very beginning, where you talked about consistency, and now you're consistent with other websites, and you look basically, you feel the same, maybe you look different. And I think that's also like, I thought about how would I start a new website if I want to be commercially successful. And I think I would simply start by looking at who are my competitors, and then I would try to imitate them. Not from a design point of view, right? Using different colors, slightly different layouts. But I mean, they have functionalities, and probably I have the very same functionality. And then I basically want to give users the feeling that this is a familiar place. And I think then you want to improve. And I think that's also, I wondered why I use Amazon, and they clearly don't have the best UI, I would say. It looks kind of strange, but I think they have the best process. So I know if I order on Amazon, I know what I have to expect from the process. Okay. And that's something I like. So I think they have a great usability for the process, but maybe not the website. I'm not sure about that, if the website is really that good compared to other websites, but it's certainly not bad.
Yeah. Well, but Amazon also plays in this whole factor of trust, right? Because you're handling money and you're kind of like prepaying goods that you hope will arrive one day. I mean, this is very different from the Wild West of eBay or Alando at the time, you know, where you would order something and then you transfer your money and hope that something gets there. More professional the website looks, the more you actually would trust that the transaction would be completed in the end. So I think that's the aspect that comes into play here with Amazon. Plus, they also, I mean, if you think about like ease of use, right? Amazon's interface is incredibly cluttered, right? It's it's not really clear, right? And it comes, I think, down to the what we talked about in the beginning, right? The user comes to Amazon, and Amazon has no, they actually do have probably an idea what you're looking for because they track you across all these other websites. However, you know, if you open up, for example, an incognito window and you came to the website, to Amazon.com, and Amazon would register you as a new user, and there's like billions of products that you can choose from, right? How do you direct the user to the right one? It's quite a challenge. And so their approach, I guess, is just like, oof. And then their customization kicks in, right? They're kind of like, oh, we've seen you before. We've seen who you've been kind of like associating yourself with. And so therefore they customize the entire mess that is their store into, well, last time you looked at this book, in the meantime, other people looked at this book. So I think they solve this by just being highly customized and sending you down a rabbit hole straight away. Like, welcome back. Did you know, I got an email the other day from them. Did you know there is a item in your shopping list? Oh. It's so easy to just, you know, complete the transaction. Yeah, I know it's easy. I just use it as a storage because I want to remember.
But it works for them. So that's...
It does seem to work for them. If you look at it.
For a lot of people as well. Something we did not talk about is, and that's, I think, kind of specific for websites, and people don't talk about it for native applications that much. I mean, nowadays they do. Accessibility. How do you approach that? And I think nowadays, maybe for native Android applications, it's actually easier to make it accessible than the website. And it used to be the other way around, I think. Like if you have a native Windows application for a desktop computer, it's completely intransparent to anything. And then the web came and made things more accessible for a lot of people. There were blind people I worked with, and they used iOS. So they used then the iPhone, and that was much better. So native iOS application was so much better than the web at that point, at least. So I think it's interesting. So that seems to change as well. So, but I don't know about the state of the art for the web today.
I think, you know, since HTML5 or something, we do have more of a semantic structure to HTML. Yeah. Right. So it's not just everything is not just divs and tables. We actually have articles and sections. And if everyone actually used them correctly, then screen readers would have much easier time to present that content to visually challenged people as well. And so I think the tools are there, but because it's somewhat of a wild, wild west and you have all these different versions of websites and HTML usage, that's what makes it really messy. But I think you can create a very decent experience for visually impaired people as well, and make your website very accessible. If you just use the right tags and you make sure that, you know, your tags have attributes for example, your captions for your images and stuff. If you look now, I think the majority of websites don't do that, and it's very unfortunate because it's basically convenience over making the website accessible for a wide audience. And I think, you know, that's where also then legislation comes in, that most government websites, I think in Germany as well, need to be accessible, right? They cannot just put their website out there. It has to, you know, follow some standards and being accessible to a broad range of people, the broadest possible.
Yeah, I mean, but it's interesting. So on iOS, Apple just forces people to stick to certain things. And then on the web, I mean, you have to, like, sure, if you develop a website for the government or for, I don't know, a university or something, then people tell you. But I talked with a friend and she said, customers, they're interested, they want to have it accessible, but they don't want to pay for it. So it's just like she worked with major car companies, and of course, it has to be that, like, that's a requirement, has to be accessible. But then how do you implement that? They don't care and they don't test it. So it's kind of there. So you have to do it, but then no one cares in the end about it. I think that's something tricky. And I think for car manufacturers, I don't know, maybe they don't care too much about visually impaired people because they typically don't drive cars, I would guess. So I think that's like the pure business in the end that makes things very challenging. Yeah. So I think what you probably want to do, you want to use frameworks that support it. And I mean, it will never work on its own, I would guess, but I mean, make sure in the beginning that you use something that at least can work out in the end and provide some decent baseline.
I would root for frameworks, for different reasons. First of all, there's the design aspect we had, right? Use a framework so that your design scales across different devices. Accessibility would be right there, up there with it. Make sure that you do that. If you use a framework, most likely the more up-to-date ones take care of the accessibility aspect as well. And third one would be the security aspect, right? Don't try security on your own if you don't know what you're doing. And that's about 99% of people, including myself. And so, you know, just like, for example, form validation, things like that, right? It's so much easier and so much secure to use existing frameworks. Of course, and also, you know, if you use something like WordPress, and then there's a much bigger incentive for WordPress to get hacked. Because if I hack WordPress, I have access to all these WordPress websites. But I know also that there's this huge team, hopefully, of cybersecurity experts, right? Test each rollout of their code base and for security holes. And so I want to make sure that I just reuse what they're giving me rather than kind of like going out on my own and trying to fix those potholes that open up if I design my own website.
Ooh, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Maybe a final thing, do you see any trends? So what's out there? Like today we use these frameworks, we still have all these native apps. What's the future? Will we stop using native applications? And is the future the appless world where we only have websites? Or do you see another future, another trend that you're aware of?
Well, I think that the app metaphor is quite useful for people to categorize the mess that is the World Wide Web into functional chunks, right? So if you look at your own web consumption, right? I don't think there are more than 10 websites that you usually or often go to, probably not even 5, right? If you don't consider a web search and wherever you end up for some information search, it's on a website, right? So I think there's a bunch of things that everyone does on the web, and we tend to mingle around the products that we like and have come to trust, And so in that sense, I think web and app will be somewhat synonymous. The way that we also think of, a web app, right? So Facebook, what is that? Is it a website? Is it an app? It's a web app, right? Because it has all these things. One thing that I've witnessed with growing concern is this incentivization around keeping users' attention, right? I think it was, what was his name? Jeff Hammerbacher. He's a data scientist. He famously said, the best minds of my generation are thinking about how to make people click ads. And that sucks. Right? And if you look now at this, if any website pretty much, or any social media website, they install this horrible idea of an endless scrolling feed. Right? So basically this notion that you can never really get to the end of a website and then kind of like find closure in the interaction, because there's always something more, always more, right? And they just use Ajax to reload more stuff into your feed. And that, you know, is just such a waste of everyone's time and cognitive resources. And so what I'm also looking into is how can we nudge people to get away from that by designing or crafting more carefully, especially reading interfaces on the web, to help people focus on what is essential and not get carried away with all the ill-incentivized intentions that a lot of these web apps put in front of you.
But would you put that on top of these applications, or is it necessary that to have it as a part of the application?
Right now, I mean, what we do is we basically crawl content and experiment with new reading interfaces that mostly gets rid of clutter, that mostly prevents a lot of these dark patterns that we see. I think for news websites, right, it might be interesting to look at how do we not just measure our success in the number of articles a user clicked or ads that they touched, but what's the actual engagement with a single article, right? And then you could probably also find better metrics for authors to kind of like say, oh, this is an author or a journalist who tends to produce content that leads to a deeper engagement, right? So you can look at that from both a design and also a content production point of view. And I think we should find ways to you know, change those incentives towards more deeper reading and interfaces or experiences. Invite people more for reflection rather than, oh, here's the next bit. And then 3 bits later, I don't even know what article I started with. Right? That's not healthy for your cognitive health. And so I would like us to go hopefully in the future towards interfaces that support our mental cognitive health well-being, and instill a bit of more like reflection and critical thinking abilities as we navigate the web.
Okay. Cool. I think that's a nice goal, and I think that's a nice end. So thanks a lot for being here with me, and hope we all had fun. Thank you.